Hi, I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 191 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crowe with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Listen Tuesdays at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on PRN.FM or subscribe as a podcast. Remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you, so send me a message. Let me know how you stay in touch with the show, what you like about it, what you don't, and suggestions. If you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift, which will be one of the bookmarks I make by hand using my own photographs. We have a long and at times emotional interview today, so let's get right to it. Dave Bona was a member of the Canadian Airborne Regiment, which was dissolved after the so-called Somalia Affair, which may have had mefloquine and quinism at its root. He was in the Canadian military for 14 years, including the First Gulf War, peacekeeping in Cyprus, Somalia, and Rwanda. He believes that his exposure to mefloquine, along with PTSD, has caused many of the challenges he faced, which included outbursts of anger and alcohol abuse. However, more recently, he has started to overcome some of the symptoms through Loretta neurofeedback therapy. Welcome to the show, Dave.
Hello.
Yes, yeah, so you were, I mean, I would say most people around the world don't really know too much about what the Canadian military does. It's often been in the shadows of the American military or the United Nations. But it was posted to some pretty traumatic places. And you talked about being in Rwanda, for example, and seeing dead bodies everywhere. Can you describe a little bit about that?
Yeah, it was quite the shock. It still haunts me to this day, that damn deployment. But you train your entire adult life to be a soldier.
Right.
And you prepare yourself for, doing soldier-type stuff, that whole close with and destroy the enemy and stuff
right.
like that. And then you go out and you end up being the cleanup crew for a massacre that involves over a million people. And it's just like, it's so outside of your experience, your, like, anything that you could even possibly be exposed to. There's nothing that could prepare you for something like that. And it,
right, because the fighting was a civil, for those who don't remember, this was back in, I think you said 1994, it was the fighting between the Houthis and the Tutsis. It's still a great deal of dispute. Some people see the current president of Rwanda as a hero. Other people see him as a big participant in the massacres. But you weren't involved in the fighting.
I was deployed over there as a member of the security element for the field hospital we deployed. And my job was primarily when they set up the ICE remote aid stations and the doctors went to different hospitals and stuff. We provided the escorts and stuff for that, and
right.
we didn't deploy with the surgeon. So what was happening too was because we were where we were located, we weren't located right in a refugee camp. What we were getting was a lot of traffic coming through the field hospital. At night after the hospital was closed, and we'd be doing security at the front gate, and you'd have someone walking up injured, and because we didn't speak Kir Rwandese, and we didn't have interpreters working directly with us while we're doing our security at night, they'd you try and because they speak French over there, that's the go language.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You try and get a sense of what's going on, and then just ends up they show you what's wrong with them, and you get a rather unexpected education, because I'm pretty sure I saw every form of breast cancer and at every different stage just by, you know, people showing you what's wrong with them. And then you have to escort these people in, you have to get the duty medic, and then
Then
in the middle of the night, you know, you're escorting an ambulance down to the Doctors Without Borders hospital, you know, down the road, so...
Right. I mean, were a lot of the people coming to the hospital injured in the fighting, or were you seeing other things?
There was, initially when we got there, there was a lot of people showing up that were injured from the fighting and activities associated with massacres. Machetes were the preferred method of killing people over there.
Right.
Massacres. So you get a lot of people, like kids and stuff, coming in with their heads, you know, half hacked,
oh, God.
And stuff like that. And then later on, we were getting a lot of vehicle accidents. Like, for example, as things stabilized in the country, a lot more drinking and driving was occurring. So you'd get a little kid that was walking up the side of the road to get water from the well.
Right.
And she got smoked by a motorbike. And
right.
You have to go pick up the broken body and, that was where it sort of progressed. Don't get me wrong, we were still getting people that were injured because there was, a week or two before we returned back to Canada, they went and did a recovery at one village because there was two kids suspected of hiding around their family's home, and they had to go search for these kids in the backyard. They finally found them underneath a rubbish pile.
These were kids who'd participated in the massacre, or?
They were subject to the massacre. Their parents were, the mom was killed at the, or I think the dad was killed at the front door of the house. And the mom was killed at the back door of the house trying to protect the kids.
Right.
To give the kids a chance to get out and hide.
Wow. And you see, you can't get these out of your mind, this kind of...
No, well, yeah, you know, you run into problems with it at the oddest. Like, I can't go to hospitals with my kids, because especially eMERGE, because if you get a screaming injured kid at the hospital, that'll set me off, and it just
right.
sort of I can't function. Just because you have you the thing with for me with PTSD is you get the emotion, the visual imagery and stuff, but that's not the stuff that really debilitates me. It's the it's the emotion that comes bubbling up, you know, like how do you put it? You can almost function through some of the visual imagery. It's like you're in slow motion.
Right.
But it's after you get over that initial blast, that's when the...
So it sort of bubbles up from the trigger.
Yeah, like that's when the all the stuff you've crammed down, like it comes up. All the emotion, and that's where I struggle with, even to this day with that, my wife was recently seriously ill, and we spent a lot of time in and out of the hospitals, and it was extremely difficult for me.
Right. Yes.
Even just transiting the different areas to get to where we had to go was... quite difficult. I got a service dog, and if I didn't have that service dog, this wouldn't have happened. I wouldn't have been able to been in the hospital for my wife.
Wow. And Rwanda was not the only traumatic place you were sent to. Perhaps Somalia is even important. And was that before Rwanda?
Yeah, that was before Rwanda. Like, I went, I did Cyprus with the UN, started off. That was a nice... easy tour deployment, relatively speaking.
And people have forgotten about Cyprus, but
yep.
It's divided between the Greeks and the Turks.
Yep.
And basically, you're standing at the line and making sure nobody starts shooting at each other.
Yeah, and that's pretty much, and it's like stupid things, like the Greek soldier, the one Greek soldier came onto the line half drunk one night and or half stoned and decided to throw a rock at the Turk soldier across the alleyway on the other side. And,
God, way to start an international incident.
And next thing you know, you've got a Turkish platoon showing up on the Turk side, and then you're sitting there in your OP, you know, on your radio, you know, calling the duty NCO.
Right.
And it was actually funny because the duty NCO on that one incident was an ex-airborne guy that was there way back when things were quite a bit more chaotic. And it was funny, he walked literally right up onto the top of the Turkish positions and started giving them shit, asking for their officers. And then he walked across onto the Greek side and pulled up their duty officer, you know, and he fucking started giving them shit. And then, like, just boom, just like that, he calmed the thing down. But it was more, you know.
But there wasn't a lot of shooting, there weren't a lot of dead people.
No. It was just you're more, how do you put it? You run into more difficulties as a young man in Cyprus than you did as a soldier.
Right.
You know, like trying to figure out your place in society with regards to alcohol use and stuff like that.
Right, and I'm sure boredom. Be a big problem there.
Yep.
So is Somalia, which I guess I didn't actually really know what the problems were in Somalia, but I assume it was kind of a civil war situation.
Yeah, it was civil war. The Somali government decided to invade Ethiopia. Ethiopia thoroughly kicked their butts.
Mm-hmm.
And in the aftermath of that military defeat, pretty much the government dissolved, and it just degenerated into this widespread civil war. And it was all, it was crazy how many different factions there were in that country.
Right, so in the absence of a central authority, you have all these strongmen. Right.
Clan chiefs and warlords and
this,
that, and the other. And I think I can't even remember the saying. I think there was like 14 kings, 28. I can't even remember. It's just a huge thing in it.
Right.
And it described the breakdown of the hierarchy within the country. And it was like, wow.
And it's way too complicated for outsiders to ever understand.
Yep.
All the different forces. Because it's not like we like a situation where it's the good guys versus the bad guys.
Yep.
But when you've got 30 different groups which have sort of shifting alliances, that makes it, you really don't know who's your friend, who's your enemy, et cetera. So Somalia was where you first encountered mefloquine?
Yes. Actually, I believe it was the first Gulf War. I was deployed also over to the first Gulf War.
Oh, okay. To which country?
Yeah, because I don't remember taking it there.
Right.
But we were only there for, it was a really, really short deployment. Like, you know, I forget how long. It was like, we were on the ground, I think, like a month.
Okay.
It was, and then the Saudis kicked us out. So, I don't recall any of the side effects while I was in Saudi Arabia, but a couple of the guys are saying that it's on their, it's recorded in their med docs, guys that I deployed with.
Okay.
So, but where I really started having problems with the mefloquine, though, was the first day I took it, because usually you take it a few weeks before you deploy.
Right.
And I remember vividly the first day I took it. We went for needle parade. And they were standing there. They gave us one of these pills, told us we had to take it. You know, that night, you know, about 15 to 45 minutes later, you know, I started to feel sick, like physically sick.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, you know, that night I was in the basement. I went walk up the stairs, and that's when I had my first seizure.
So just to be clear, you were at home.
Yep.
So you were not in a stressful situation. You were not in a place people were dead or shooting at you or anything like that. You were in a Canadian home, your home.
Yep. I was at home, and I was literally walking up the stairs. All of a sudden, I had to grab the railing. My vision went black, and I started seeing stars. And this only lasted for a few seconds, but after the vision came back, you know, I was all disorientated and dizzy. And, it just went downhill from there.
Right.
The longer I was on the drug, the more problems I was having. Like, as the deployment progressed, I would get, the day we took the pill, I would get hyper anxious. Hypervigilant, hyper anxious. Like my moods were getting darker and deeper, and anger, like holy shit, was I getting angry, and I get angry fast.
Yes, and this was not your experience before.
Oh God, no! I was so mellow and laid back. This is the direct opposite of who I was and who I am.
Like. Right, and you hadn't really been in any traumatic military situations at this point. You've been in Cyprus, right? The first Gulf War.
No, I was exposed to trauma in a training accident well before I deployed to Somalia. We were doing live fire trench clearing, and one of the guys ahead of me managed to blow himself up with a grenade while we're doing the trench clearing.
Okay.
It wasn't like, you know, he didn't die or anything, but he just peppered his leg with his knee and his leg with grenade fragments.
Okay.
You know, but it was still, you know, he's rolling around, he drops his C9, turns around, drops it, pointed back down, and it's a blowback action rifle, and he didn't have the safety on, and I still to this day don't know how I'm alive.
Right.
You know, he dropped it in the trench, and I'm sitting there, you know, all hunkered down, just getting ready to go around the corner, you know, behind him, and looking at the barrel of the C9. It's like, holy fuck.
Yes. That,
you know,
yes.
And then, then you're trying to, then the safety staff's jumping into the trench, trying to give him first aid, and they're kicking the C9 around, and you're trying to push people out of the way to get the scene, you know?
Right, get it where it's safe.
I look back, and that's where the PTSD stuff started for me, because immediately after that, you know, that's like the effects of PTSD were, that's where it started for me with PTSD.
Right.
But the thing with the PTSD, like, you know, it was the visual imagery, the reliving the experience and stuff like that. It was manageable though, you know, like it was debilitating to the point, but it was, you were still functional, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
It didn't wipe you right out. But the difference we ran into was when I was on methloquin, when I was exposed to trauma, it's almost like the methloquin made the trauma worse. Like, for example, I was was there when a friend of mine was shot, and like that experience compared to the previous one where a friend blew himself up with a grenade was so dramatically different. It's like the methloquin amplified the exposure to the trauma. You know, it's like it you know how you have a volume on a stereo. You know, it's just at normal room temperature or volume, just, you know, ba da 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 da. And that was, you know, the experience I had with Jason when he blew himself up. And then when Mike got shot, you know, like it's like you crank the volume right up, and it imprinted on you stronger, like it affected you more profoundly.
Right. Another factor is that these were your friends. Like, you saw a lot of horrible things, but it seems common sense to me that if you see a friend or colleague...
No, the thing is, I don't know if anyone else had this experience, but you can rationalize your friends getting injured doing their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, that's sort of within your scope of experience and training, you know? Like, people are going to get injured doing this type of work.
You're trained to expect that some of your friends will get injured or killed.
That's part of, you know, like, the training, you know? Like, when you're doing your basic battle drills and, you know, part of the thing is, you know, consolidate on the objective, you know? You got, you know, your reserve section coming through type thing. You know, their job is to, you know, sort out the wounded and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just sort of, you know, so you're sort of exposed to it that you're expecting people to get injured.
Right.
You know, so you can rationalize that. You can put that in a little box. You know, the trauma with, you know, pulling a kid out of a minefield or giving a kid a handful of candy and then, you know, 10 minutes later, this kid picking up an unexploded grenade. You know, that's the trauma that you can't put in a box.
Right, right.
That's the trauma that, the friends getting injured still, you know, it still comes up. But this other stuff that you can't put in a box.
Right, right. That's interesting.
More profoundly hits you, especially if you've been like, on methloquine. I can't stress that enough. It's just like the methloquine potentiates the PTSD.
I mean, I think it's important to, you know, you've done a pretty good job in what I've read of sort of how do you know, because the symptoms of methloquine and PTSD overlap so much, but, you know, what you've said is the first time you took methloquine, you were at home. So,
yep.
Although you had a traumatic experience before, most of the traumatic experiences you had were in the future. And also, it was given once a week, right? It's a weekly
yep.
drug. So you, every week you had the experience of feeling different after the methloquine.
Yep. The methloquine nights for me, I never slept when I took methloquine. There'd be probably a good 48 hours I would not sleep. Just because for me, when I had my vivid dreams were like, some people got lucky. They go, oh yeah, I had these crazy, crazy sex dreams and stuff like
right.
that. I never had those.
Yes.
I wish I had those.
Right.
Mine were like, you know, it was me graphically killing the members of my section. It was me graphically killing my family.
Mm. Which is sadly, you know, in that case in Nova Scotia, I wasn't really prepared for this, but there was the case Lionel
yep.
Desmond, who killed his wife and daughter, I think.
Yeah, I talked actually with his sister, the last person to talk to him, and
right.
What he was experiencing just prior to that incident was he was having what's called a methloquine rage. And how we know he was having a methloquine rage is when you have a methloquine rage, what happens is your pupils will fully dilate.
Mm-hmm.
You'll talk funny, you'll walk funny. Like there's very prominent physiological changes that occur when you're having a methloquine rage. Like, and you cannot control these rages.
Yeah, you quoted your wife as saying that you turn a different color and
yep.
then basically go nuts.
Yep.
And
there's nothing I can do to stop them.
Right.
When they happen.
I've interviewed Remington Nevin. I have to think before I say his name because I always want to
yep.
say it backwards. I can never think what's
yep.
the first name, what's the last name. I've interviewed him twice, and the one point he's made is that this drug is not flushed out of your system. It's basically in there permanently. I mean, we don't know what might happen 50 years down the line, but it really doesn't matter. That's essentially permanent, which is horrifying. That you've got something in you that
I've come across four members of the Canadian Airborne Regiment that deployed in Somalia. All four of these members have died in long-term care facilities under the age of 40 with MS-like symptoms. Basically, the drug ate their brain.
Right.
Four guys out of a thousand.
Yes, that's pretty high.
That's and I'm not looking. Mm-hmm. This is, you know, there's one guy here in Saskatchewan that I used to work with his brother, and that's why I know about him. But these other three, these are people tracking me down and asking about, you know, the sister of a soldier.
It's okay. Just take your time.
You know, just looking for answers, and it's just like, once you start describing the behavioral stuff going on with methylquin and the physical symptoms of someone that's been poisoned by methylquin, you know, she's going, that's it. That's exactly what he had, you know?
Yes.
Like, and under the age of 40 in a long-term care facility.
That's pretty unusual unless, I mean, I've seen people who got in a traumatic car accident and had severe brain injury in one of those facilities.
Yep.
But it's certainly where
not their
normal.
Body, like they don't know what's going on with them, and these people are just they slowly die.
Yes.
You know, like they're slowly dying. Like these deaths could have been prevented with, hey, you've been poisoned by methylquin.
And yet,
you know, like it's absolutely sickening that the governments are, just to save a few dollars, are dragging their heels.
Yeah, I mean, what was described to me by Remington Nevin was that the weekly giving of the drug saves money and time for the military.
30 cents a pill. Molaren, the proven safe once-a-week drug, was $14.
Right. So, I mean, that obviously adds up to
the cost of a couple Starbucks coffees.
Right. And, you know, you could say that adds up to a lot of money for thousands of soldiers. But on the other hand, the cost of the ramifications of methylquin. But, of course, most of those costs are not borne by the military. Once
no, they're
out,
borne by the provincial health services. Like, I've gotten young soldiers pulled out of psych wards here in Saskatchewan. And how I was able to do that was, you know, they've either reached out to me or family members reached out to me, and I talked to the individual. You know, I established, was he on methylquin? Okay, did he have an adverse reaction? What's happening right now? Why are you in the psych ward? Well, he was busted by the cops right in the middle of a methylquin rage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he ended up locked down in a psych ward until he calmed down.
Right.
You know? And then talking to this individual and contacting this individual's doctor and putting this doctor in contact with Dr. Nevin, you know, getting some case study that this doctor can, you know, relate to his client
right.
that's in lockout. You know, we're able to get this guy out of the psych ward.
Is this some kind of organization, or is this just kind of word of mouth that there's people like you who are willing
to help?
Just word of mouth.
Like, there's the International Methylquin Veterans Alliance.
Mm-hmm.
John Dow helped form.
I think I interviewed him, too.
Yep. There's also the Methylquin Aware... sorry, I'm a little bit triggered. My brain's stopping working.
Yeah,
yeah. Hang on, I got a bumper sticker right here.
Okay.
It's methylquinawareness.ca, another website. And then what happens there, not only just through word of mouth, but I get people referred to me through these two organizations and that. And then I establish contact with them. Then we go through the whole routine because, you know, number one, you have to establish, were they on methylquin? Did they have the adverse reaction?
Right.
You know, what symptoms are they having now? The symptoms they're having now related to methylquin? Because we're running into issues. Like, I've got several guys that for lack of a better term, they're absolutely screwed. They're not only are they poisoned by mefloquine, but they've got traumatic brain injuries. They've got severe PTSD.
Well, that's another thing, because when people talk about PTSD, by traumatic brain injury, are you talking about like
an explosion? IEDs and stuff like that.
Right. So an explosion nearby can cause brain damage, basically shaking your brain.
Yeah.
So you have a lot of different things to consider.
Yeah, but the thing what we know now, though, is if you can get focused treatment on the mefloquine poisoning,
mm-hmm.
all the other symptoms for your other injuries will be reduced.
Right. Now, let's talk about that. You talked about Loretta neurofeedback,
yes.
but are there other things that you can do?
What we're finding, like, when you're poisoned by mefloquine, the part of your brain that's damaged is actually the brain stem. And mm-hmm. what is actually damaged? You have to look at the physical symptoms people are having to figure out what is damaged. And the bulk of the people that have been poisoned by mefloquine, they have a brainstem injury on the top back side of the brainstem. And there's various nerve clusters that travel right underneath the surface in that area. And the most prominent one that's affected is the one that's called the dorsal nucleus of the vagus.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the one that's responsible for muscle tone in your digestive system. It's responsible for secretions within your digestive system. It's also responsible, has cardiac muscle, has on your lungs.
Right. And these are nerves that you're not even aware of, right? Like you don't think my heart needs to beat now, that my digestive system.
These nerves actually connect these organs to your brain.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And the thing is, when this nerve cluster is damaged, the nerves don't conduct the signals properly. For example, people with really bad acid reflux, what's actually happening is due to this damage to this nerve cluster, their stomachs are not receiving the signal to produce the appropriate amount of acid.
Right.
So what happens then is, so it's underproducing acid. Now, this is counterintuitive to if mm-hmm. where people trip up a bit. So, but what's actually happening is it's not producing enough acid, and the stomach senses, and it has its own way to turn it on, the acid, but what actually turns it off is a signal from the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And because that nerve cluster is damaged, it's not getting the signal to turn off that acid production.
So do people with mefloquine poisoning or mefloquine adverse reactions have more digestive system problems?
I'll run through the list that I've come up with after talking with well over 150 veterans and civilians that have been poisoned by mefloquine.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, the most common one being is PTSD that does not respond to treatment.
Like talk therapy treatment?
Yeah, nothing works. Mm-hmm. No conventional PTSD treatment will work for someone that's mm-hmm. poisoned by mefloquine.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, pharmaceutical interventions and stuff like that will just make your symptoms worse.
Right, which is the go-to, right? Give the guy a pill and send him home.
Yeah, and what you'll see a lot is with military veterans is they get on this escalating escalator that seems to be going up, right?
In terms of the number of prescription drugs.
Well, what happens is they'll start off with, you know, a sleeping pill,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then they'll be on a you know, something to help them moderate their mood a bit, you know, a little bit of Ativan and stuff like that. But what you're finding is the effectiveness of these drugs is not that great when you have a brain injury.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens then is they max out the doses. And then what they'll do is they'll bounce the individual from a pill to a pill, and then they have to give them more pills to counteract the side effects of pills. And then, like, I was talking to a guy a couple months back that was in Somalia with us, and he is absolutely ruined by these pills. His brain is absolutely fried. His liver is fried. His guts are done from the pills. You know, methylene poisoning is one thing, but this unethical, unnecessary pharmaceutical interventions are entirely other ball of wax.
Well, I mean, it's kind of inevitable with a medical system that the question is not what's the right treatment, but what's the right drug. You know, if stuff doesn't work, it's like, well, obviously we didn't give enough drugs.
Yep.
Or not the right combination. Yep. It's sort of inevitable that this will happen to people who have seemingly intractable problems.
Yep.
So what does help with these
with
people?
With methylene poisoning, what we're finding is the simple things are best. Like, now, it's kind of like, let me go back to my list. I'll run through my list of how to tell if someone's been poisoned by methylene.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I'll run through the list real quick, and then I'll explain what management works to reduce these symptoms.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And then I'll explain what treatments we're finding work. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So number one is PTSD that doesn't respond to treatment.
Right.
Number two is gut issues, either acid reflux, loose stool, or severe constipation, or a combination of the both, all three. What we're finding is tinnitus.
Ringing of the ears.
Yeah. Sensitivity to light.
Mm-hmm.
Sleep issues. Chronic insomnia.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Body temperature regulation issues. People will wake up periodically, like their sheets soaking wet.
Mm-hmm.
Or, for example, me, I'm driving down the highway, it's minus 40 out, and all of a sudden, I start sweating.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, I'm in my van with the kids, and I literally start set a full head-to-toe sweat. Like, even the roots of my hair are sweating.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I have to crank the window open until my kids in the back seat are turning blue and are chattering.
Right.
And I have to roll the window back up.
Yes.
But, you know, body temperature regulation issues. They'll have numbness and tingling in the extremities. Like, for example, a lot of people report tingling and numbness in the front of their thighs,
mm-hmm.
Their forearms, their hands. I get the numbness and tingling in the forearm or the front of my thighs and my arms.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes when it's really, really bad, like I work as a framer, I can't even hold my hammer. I've launched my hammer across a construction site a couple of times, you know,
mm-hmm.
just because the numbness and tingling was so bad, but you still got to work, you know?
Yes, yes.
Balance and dizziness issues.
Mm-hmm.
When they go to get up out of a chair, they have to stop and hold the arms of the chair because they feel dizzy.
Right.
They'll be very susceptible to, for example, are you familiar with the CN Tower?
Yes, in Toronto.
Okay, it's got a gentle sway to it.
Oh, really? I've never been up it.
Yeah, it's got a little gentle sway,
right.
Very imperceptible,
mm-hmm.
you know, when it's windy, but you can feel it.
Right.
You know, I was up in the CN Tower, and I was almost puking. Like,
really?
I got up there, stepped off the elevator, and it was just like, holy shit.
Yes.
Back on the elevator, back down.
Wow.
Another example is I tried out, because I did for 12 years of firefighting out in the bush, as an air attack officer.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the thing is you had to ride in small aircraft. I was okay when it's flat and level, but as soon as you turn the wing over on its side and I lost visual reference to the horizon,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
like I'd start puking. I had
wow.
no control over it.
Wow.
So...
Okay, more on your list of symptoms.
Yeah,
so far.
Yeah, well, there's more. You know, difficulty managing moods, and with the managing moods, we got to break it down into a a lot of this is some of it's sleep related. You know, if you're chronically, like I used to go 14 days with no sleep.
Right.
And finally I'd just go get drunk and then I'd be able to pass out and then I'd be good to go for another 2 weeks type thing. But your ability to function is severely impaired.
Right. So
that's part of the mood management. But the other part of the mood management is actually the mefloquine rages. This is the inexplicable, and it's just not, you know, angry, I'm throwing shit around and, you know, stuff like that. This is also an extreme negative focus. You know, some people, they don't have that propensity for violence.
Mm-hmm.
So they get extremely negative focus. And what you find is a lot of women, the men seem to tend towards violence, whereas the women, you know, and extreme anger, and where the women seem to really focus towards negative focus on stuff that is extreme and unreasonable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's the basic list. There's a bunch of other stuff, but that is the basic list I use when I first talk to people. So.
And so now what do you do about it?
What do you do? Well, first I got to, you know, you got to explain what the injury is. Once you understand what the injury is from mefloquine, it's a brainstem injury. It's not a gut issue. There's nothing wrong with the front of your legs. You know, there's...
Oh, I see, yes.
All that stuff's fine. Once you understand that it's a brainstem injury and the surface of that brainstem has been exposed to a toxic substance that's burned holes through it and exposed the tissue underneath, so you're really susceptible to inflammation. If you can control the amount of neural inflammation you have, you can reduce your symptoms from mefloquine poisoning.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you do that? One of the biggest things is, you know, what you eat. We've got people here in Canada that have been extremely successful in mitigating the mefloquine poisoning symptoms just by watching what they eat. And the most prominent guy is a guy by the name of Stephen Beardwood. He works at Veterans House. Uh-huh. He was one of our medics in Somalia, and he literally completely eliminated the mefloquine rages from happening just by going to a really healthy, clean diet.
No what
processed
do you mean?
Foods, no McDonald's.
Oh, okay.
You know, homegrown, you know, like healthy eating.
Right. So that, I mean, you seem to be implying that like the traces of pesticides and things like that you would get in commercial
food. Yes, that's it. But, you know, like if you look at, for example, processed foods.
Right.
And I'll use McDonald's as an example. It's proven that there is very little nutritional value in McDonald's food. Okay. And what you're running into is, like, there's a couple of issues going on here with the healthy eating. Is your body is not digesting food. If you have loose stool or really bad acid reflux, your body is not digesting what you're eating properly.
Right. And if you're eating low nutrient
crap
food,
like McDonald's, like when I eat McDonald's, like my neighbor's a framer, and I go work with him every once in a while, and he loves McDonald's because it's cheap and it's fast.
Mm.
You know, and you can eat it in the truck on the way back to the job site. It's kind of funny. But, you know, go for breakfast with them, have McDonald's breakfast. You know, after that, I'm feeling a bit off.
Mm-hmm.
And I have lunch at McDonald's. By that afternoon, I'm actually mefloquine raging.
Mm-hmm.
I'm snapping and losing my shit.
Right.
And what's happening is, remember I pointed out that the mefloquine burnt holes through the surface of the brainstem. It also burnt holes through different things. One of the most important one being the temporal lobe. There's a sac that surrounds it. And this is what's suspected of happening with the mefloquine rage. This is actually a temporal lobe seizure. You can't control it.
Mm-hmm.
It has to run its course. And the temporal lobe can't maintain positive pressure. So when you get your PTSD gets activated, and you get all hypervigilant, you know, your brain goes through all its available nutrients and resources, like fast.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Or when you drink too much coffee.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the caffeine will amp up your brain. Because if I have a cup of caffeinated coffee, I can induce a mefloquine rage.
Wow. What about high-fat diets? Do those help or hinder?
Honestly, I'm not a dietitian and all that. I just know what works for me. I do a lot of healthy, clean eating, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And when I don't do healthy, clean eating, that's where I run into problems. That's where I really start to struggle again with mood management and stuff.
Right, right.
Like, severely struggle with it. So, like, for example, I foolishly took the kids out for lunch. So we went to a Vietnamese restaurant, and they were closing, and I usually get a very, vermicelli bowl, and it's and they
right.
don't put a lot, they don't put MSG in
mm-hmm.
the little vermicelli bowls and that, and they're and you get the vermicelli bowl and some fresh rolls. You know, it's fairly healthy, and it's this place ain't too expensive.
Right.
But when we went, it was just a little bit too late, and they had an order there that someone there was a no show,
mm-hmm.
and like a big dumbass.
Right.
You know, the guy go, oh, yeah, for $30 you can have this. Like, oh, great, yeah, we'll have lunch in that tomorrow. Yeah, we'll
right,
have
right.
a snack tonight. You know, that's great.
Good deal.
Holy fuck, I've been battling for, like, 48 hours after that. I've been absolutely struggling, like, holding off the mefloquine rages and stuff like that. You know, like, just, you know, isolating myself from the family, using a lot of CBD oil, you know. Just,
right.
You
cannabis
know,
oil.
It was just the crappy food, and it had MSG in it. And
yeah, I don't have these mefloquine rage problems, obviously, but I know that free food is a problem, probably for everybody, right?
Yep.
It's hard to resist
yep.
when there's, you know, whether it's free food, whether it's a dozen donuts or something like that,
yep.
and you know your brain is saying, well, it'll get thrown out if you don't eat it, and
yep.
it looks good, so you end up eating stuff that you wouldn't have bought yourself, and suffering the consequences. We've been talking for a while, and I want to make sure that we get to talk about the Loretta
okay.
neurofeedback, because you
okay.
said that
I'll,
that was...
I'll just quickly finish up on the foods, and
sure,
then we'll
yeah, mm-hmm.
cut into the... We'll just cut... I'll finish up with the management, and then we'll cut into treatment. The big thing with the management is food.
Mm-hmm.
Healthy eating. You
right.
know, avoid caffeine, and... that's pretty much it with that, you know, and
right.
super high-strength probiotics, because the people with the loose stool,
okay.
what's happening is what they have is wet gut. Their guts are over-secreting.
Mm-hmm.
So it's cleaning all the flora and fauna, and if you get the people to use super high-strength probiotics, that will get their guts working again,
mm-hmm,
and get
mm-hmm.
them digesting food and getting the fuel that their brain needs to function.
And
they can hold off the mefloquine rages.
Right, and if they've been on a lot of pharmaceuticals, a lot of pharmaceuticals are damaging to the gut
oh.
bacteria, so that's obviously going to help there as well.
Yeah, yeah. So that's basically management in a nutshell is, you know, getting your guts working. That's that, like that's the cornerstone of managing the mefloquine poisoning, whether
mm-hmm.
it's the acid reflux or the loose stool or the constipation, because what's happening is you're not digesting the food properly.
Mm-hmm.
And your gut, the residence time of that food in your digestive system is not sufficient for it to get the nutrients and the chemicals extracted that it needs to supply your brain.
Right, right.
So once that's done, then we focus on the treatment. What
mm-hmm.
treatment works? Okay. I have talked to a lot of people. I've referred a lot of people for Loretta neurofeedback.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm finding, and I've been doing follow-ups with a few people, there is Loretta neurofeedback, and then there's neurofeedback. The base cost for setting up a proper Loretta neurofeedback is $100,000.
Wow.
The base cost for setting up the basic neurofeedback is like $4,000.
Okay.
And these neurofeedback clinics are popping up all over the place, and we're running into problems because people are doing the treatments and they're not getting better with the neurofeedback.
Mm-hmm.
The Loretta neurofeedback the difference between that is it's an individual that has, in real time, can monitor what is going on with your brain in a 3D scan image, and they can adjust the program, and the program adjusts to get the outcome that you want the brain to have. Neurofeedback is not that great. Moretta neurofeedback is actually very good.
So you're basically seeing a visualization of your brain, and you can recognize the different states of the brain when you're very angry or
and
when you're
the
calm.
The reason why I push the Loretta neurofeedback, and I'm speaking from personal experience here, is when you've been poisoned by mefloquine, you will struggle with depression.
Mm-hmm.
Loretta neurofeedback kicks the shit out of that depression.
Yes.
If you can get people, if you can take anything away from this interview, is that.
But $100,000, I mean, does the government cover this?
No, this is private clinics. They purchase this equipment, and they do this treatment.
So you're not saying it costs you $100,000. You're saying it costs $100,000 to get
provider. The point I was trying to make is anyone and everyone is jumping on this neurofeedback bandwagon, and they're just giving really basic treatment that in some cases can be harmful. And I've come across a few people that, I won't elaborate, but it's not good. Okay.
Right. But
whereas if they go to a neuropsychologist, someone who's trained and invested a great deal, because that's the base price is $100,000 to get into the Loretta neurofeedback game, but you have to do monthly upgrades. You have to constantly go for training. The
you're talking about the therapist.
And it is very, very, very expensive to maintain this equipment. But this is where you get the best bang for your buck. Is
right.
That Loretta? And I can't stress that enough. Loretta neurofeedback, not neurofeedback.
Right.
Loretta.
So you have yes, I got it.
Okay.
You
will absolutely kick the shit out of the depression, and that's the problem we're running into with people that have been poisoned by mefloquine, is we don't have a PTSD problem in our military and veteran populations. We have a mefloquine poisoning problem, and I'm going to say it, that the mefloquine is the causing this suicide epidemic we're having right now.
In the military. In Canada and the United States, yes.
But it's not just the military and veteran populations anymore. It's in the civilian population, but we've got in the civilian population, it's a lot more subtle. Because a lot of, with the civilian travelers, because they're not exposed to, because a lot of the problems with the mefloquine, I believe, are related to, for example, I was in a desert.
Mm-hmm.
We were severely restricted on water, so our bodies weren't able to effectively flush the mefloquine out of our system,
right,
so it concentrated more in our brains, you know, caused more damage, you know. Whereas with civilian travelers, you know, they're on these trips, they're at, you know, 4 or 5 star resorts, or, you know, like they're well hydrated, well nourished.
And it's not as long.
Functioning more better.
Right.
And a lot of the travelers are not having, if they're not having issues right away, they're really starting to have issues when they come down off the drug. That's when they're getting hit. So they're back from their trip, and then they start to feel sick.
Right.
And then they have this long-term, you know, neuropsychiatric issues.
Right.
Health issues that, you know, are not really connected to their trip.
Right. We're running out of time.
Okay.
So you're going to a conference in Ottawa sponsored by the Queenism Foundation, which is run by Remington.
What we're going to is a mefloquine rally on Parliament Hill that is on the 19th, and the 19th is the date that Claude Lalancette a few years ago did a hunger strike on Parliament Hill to draw attention to this issue.
Okay.
So, and this has just been put together by Marge Matchie, and assisted by myself, John Dow, you know, a lot of other people. But Marge Matchie.
Right, but there's some kind of a meeting on the day before, right, on the
18th? Yeah, the Quinism Foundation will be having an official meeting on the 18th.
Okay.
To discuss the implications of methylquinone poisoning with your application for VA coverage and stuff like that. And basically education on give people information on methylquinone poisoning.
Okay.
Yep.
Well, I'm going to attend, so I'm looking forward to meeting a lot of
people. You can't miss me. I'll be the 6'4" guy with the moon gray.
Okay, you're taller than me.
Yeah.
not too many people. Thank you very much. I know I could tell that sometimes these memories are traumatic, so I really appreciate you sharing some very difficult times in your life, but it's also good to know that things are getting better for you and hopefully for a lot of other
people. Well, the thing is, once you really looked at it and go, okay, what do you have PTSD or do you have methylquinone poisoning? Well, no, I have both. But the thing is, once I started treating the methylquinone poisoning, focused my treatment on the methylquinone poisoning, the PTSD stuff got better. It's still there, don't get me wrong. The difference now is I don't get as swamped when I get triggered. Because before, you know, it was potentiated by the methylquinone symptoms and stuff like that. A lot of the stuff associated with the methylquinone poisoning, like it damages your balance and dizziness and visual acuity or processing and all that. And that generates this low-level anxiety. Once you get rid of that low-level anxiety, you know, your PTSD stuff, you know, it's more way more manageable.
Thank you so much for sharing this with me today.
Any other questions, or if you got people that want to talk to me, feel free to give them my contact information.
I will keep that. I won't put it directly on the website, but if people contact me, I'll get them in contact with you, and I'll look forward to meeting you in person. And we'll continue to follow this story, which is kind of under-publicized, I think.
It's under the radar.
It's
governments are actively denying the issue because there's a huge price tag associated with this. All of a sudden, instead of the provincial or the local health agencies dealing with all these methylquinone symptoms, you know, the governments, actually federal governments, go, okay, well, we poisoned them. Now we gotta pay for it.
Yes.
Like I went through. If I look at all the interventions I had through my provincial health system, you know, I've had 4 or 5 liver function tests. I've done multiple cardiac interventions. You know, like what's going on with all the, you know, the racing heart I have. You know, stuff like that. You know, like the cost to our provincial health dollars. For me alone, it's in the hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Right. And,
you know?
And of course, they were saving a few dollars on each pill they gave you. Okay.
Thank you. Were saving a shit ton of money on those pills.
Right.
Yeah, they were.
We've got to end this, or
no problem.
I'll have to start cutting stuff out. Thank you so much for joining me today, and goodbye.
Hey, no problem.
Thank you for listening to episode 191 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com, like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.